tonight on Arena. Five movies in a bumper review movie slot. Alex Lawther joins us to talk Leonard and Hungry Paul and two more RTE short story finalists. If you would like to text the programme tonight, as always, you can email us arena@rte.ie. We are on Instagram @rte_arena. We have to get cracking because it's a bumper night tonight on Arena's film reviews. No less than five on offer for you this week. First up is Ballad of a Small Player. Colin Farrell is a professional gambler named Lord Doyle in the Chinese gambling mecca of Macau. Next, After the Hunt takes us to Yale, where Julia Roberts is a brilliant philosophy professor caught in the eye of a storm when a star student accuses one of her colleagues of rape. Film number three is the documentary Gerry Adams, A Ballymurphy Man, featuring the former president of Sinn Féin looking back on the last six decades. Then Roof Man, a crime caper inspired by the maddest of true stories. Channing Tatum is a charming robber hiding out in a toy store when he falls for Kirsten Dunst, who's one of the employees. And finally, Good Fortune, in which Aziz Ansari is a struggling gig worker in LA, lying to his parents about how well he's doing. And then he meets the angel Gabriel, played by Keanu Reeves, and a millionaire Seth Rogen. Donald Clark and Serena Bellissimo have been to the pictures for us. Ballad of a Small Player is where we will start. Serena, set us up with this. Where are we?
Do we really need to start with this one?
We are, whether you like it or
not. We're with Colin Farrell, who I love because he takes many risks in his career. And with this film, he's taken a big risk. He is a gambler. Well, we don't know this to begin with, because when we're first introduced to him, he's in Macau living the high life. He's Lord Doyle. And as we get into the story, we find out that there's more to, than meets the eye with this man, and he owes a lot of money in debt. And I want to say something that I can't, because if I say it, it then will spoil the...
And we will get into trouble for that.
We will. So I'm not going to spoil it, but let's just say he goes on a journey trying to recoup the money he owes. And in this journey, he also comes across Tilda Swinton, because he's been hiding out in Macau. Nobody knows where he is. Tilda Swinton finds him. She's going to get a lot of money if she brings him home. And then we go on that journey. And that's all I'm going to say, because I really don't want to spoil it.
Okay, Donald, maybe talk to us then about Colin Farrell's character. I mean, how much do you think this relentless spiral that he goes through serves as a strength or as a weakness for the film?
Well, I think he's very well cast in this. I mean, what we're looking at here is sort of a version of the kind of characters that you encountered in Somerset Maugham stories or Graham Greene stories. You know, I mean, in this case, he's a gambler, but it could be a whiskey priest equally as much. You know, a cast somewhere in what was once part of the empire, often, but not in this case, in the gambling empire that is Macau, and gradually going to seed, and in fact accelerating his progress to seed through his own misdeeds. And I think there's so much good to be said about Colin Farrell. I know it sounds like we're kind of oiling up one of our heroes, but I mean, I do mean it. I mean, the guy has had an interesting career, you know, that he had a few troubles, you know, earlier on 20 years ago or whatever. And then he kind of shook himself and said, I'm going to work with interesting directors and play interesting characters. Now, I mean, I sense from what Serena says that she's not entirely behind Ballad of a Small Player, and I've got my reservations as well, but I do think the central character is very well created. And one thing it profits from greatly is the fact that Farrell, you know, unusually amongst a lot of leading men, is perfectly prepared to be pathetic, is perfectly prepared to be a loser. And that's what this guy ultimately is. When we this is no spoiler here, we meet him at his lowest ebb. We meet him surrounded by disused beer bottles, and, well, actually, disused champagne bottles, and by stubbed out cigars in this very posh suite in Macau. And he is told that he'll be out unless he can come up with several hundred thousand dollars by Monday. And he is very good at, like, retaining the charm that he always brings to screen, but also getting at somebody who at heart is like, it's, you just know, is on a rapeting and ricketing momentum towards disaster. And rather than reacting with kind of like, you know, courage and good nature, he's quite clear at some point he's going to sink into utter pathos. I think it's a really good performance in a film that it has its issues.
Okay, let's take something from the film. This is Colin Farrell as Lord Doyle, where he meets Tilda Swinton, who is tailing him in Macau.
Hello.
Hi.
Lord Doyle.
I'm sorry?
You can call me Freddy.
Oh, thanks.
First time to Macau?
sorry.
James, it's your first trip to Macau.
Yes. You?
Nah, I come and go.
Oh, that sounds exciting.
I don't mean to be forward, but I'd be grateful if you could delete that photo.
What?
Yeah, the one you just took of me now on the lift.
Oh, the selfie?
Yes, with me in it.
Oh, no. Oh, I had no idea.
Well, I hate to ask. It's just my privacy means... It means rather a lot to me.
Why?
Why?
I mean, you're not on the run, are you?
No. No. There's no great mystery to it. It's simply that every genuine high roller values discretion.
Oh.
Yes, discretion is our code.
Oh, it is.
It is, actually.
Yeah. Because, actually, you look, I mean... If I were to say, like a bit of a show-off for someone on the lam.
You didn't tell me your name.
Betty.
Betty who?
Grayson.
Okay, Serena, what do you make of the look of the film? It looks great in the trailers, the costuming, art direction. What about that?
We cannot fault the look of the film. It looks absolutely stunning. I was wondering, look, as Donald said, you could tell by my voice, I'm not really a fan of this film. I am a massive fan of Colin Farrell and the risks he takes and the fact that he is so good in this. And I was wondering, why is Netflix releasing this at the cinema? Because things only get released at the cinema for Netflix. They're out for 2 weeks just so they can enter it into the Oscar race. And I was thinking, have they entered this so Colin may get an... I don't think he will, but, you know, did they have high hopes that Colin might get a nod for Best Actor? Or did they also hope, well, maybe this, you know, the cinematography, the set design, the costume design, maybe they will be nominated for an Oscar because it is of exceptional quality and it is absolutely stunning. But Rick, that's not enough to keep me going. And you know what? Fair play to this film. It doesn't go for 2 hours. It goes for an hour and 41 minutes. And even at that, I was checking my watch going, oh, is this still going?
Okay, we have to, I don't want to ask this question. We do have to crack on though. So Donald, stars?
Well, I would just quickly, the one thing, the reason why I think they have Oscar potential is because directed by Edward Berger, who's had two Best Picture nominees in a row with Conclave and All Quiet on the Western Front. So that's, I think, what's put it in that position. Yeah, I think it falls apart in the end. They don't really find the justification for where the story goes. Nonetheless, I think it's a solid enough three.
Okay. Really?
Serena.
I'm going to be really generous. I'm going to give it 2.5. And they're all for Colin.
They're not that far away from each other as positions, right? Next to After the Hunt from Luca Guadagnino. Donald, we're in Yale. It looks amazing. Everybody's incredibly smart and they're dressed
and
very
famous.
Well and famous. But what's happening on campus?
Oh, God. I mean, I'm starting to find it in a peculiar place. The film begins with a series of opening credit sequences that are clearly using the typeface that Woody Allen has used for 40 years. So, I mean, really explicitly, any movie fan will recognize this. I think, what's he all about here? And later on, when he was asked about it, when Luca Guadagnino was asked about it, the director, he said, like, it was an interesting nod to thinking of an artist who has been, in a way, facing some problems. Ah, so it's kind of about Woody Allen rather than about Woody Allen's films. You're referencing the personal problems he's had in his life, which in a sense is kind of a troll. And this whole film is a colossal troll, which I found incredibly juvenile, and it annoyed me in all the wrong ways. I mean, it's supposed to irritate you. It's supposed to get at people who are infuriated about what they perceive to be the rise of woke, heavily inverted commas, politics everywhere about, but also to annoy some people who are on the opposite side, because there are clearly kind of like arguments being made in both directions. The plot essentially is we begin with a gathering of Yale academics. Interestingly, it is actually Yale. They keep mentioning that university, so presumably they had to agree to sign up to this ghastly project. But they're also run in a very, very crude, satirical version of academic speak. Transpires that the Julie Roberts' character is in competition with Andrew Garfield's character for tenure. He is convinced he'll get the job because the common enemy has been chosen, and it's a straight, white, cis male. Boo! Boo! Down with woke! All this sort of thing. Then we have this incident where he allegedly sexually assaults Ayo Edebiri's character. He gets thrown out. But why is she being believed immediately? You can see where this is going. It's incredibly crude. None of this is backed up by any kind of substantial or amusing dialogue. None of it's based up by satisfactory plot twists. It is just, to me, a series of really pathetic and infantile trolls trying to get a reaction from the audience. And interesting to see, actually, I have seen Noman respond to this film by saying it's disgraceful that he is taking a subject that is so lightly, that he is playing down the dangers of sexual abuse on campus. The film is too bad to let to get involved in that, the conversation that he's kind of half having. Just a disaster.
Serena, you're sort of nodding here. Tell me why.
I am. I just want to just give something that Luca did say, though. He did say he purposefully made this film ambiguous because he wanted the audience to walk away and have real discussions. I'm agreeing. But Donald, I am agreeing with you because most of the discussions that were had were, what did we see up on screen? I was at an audience screening on Monday night. I counted about 7 people who left early. because this is the other thing. Now, look, it's Luca Guadagnino. So it looks stunning, Rick. He's getting amazing performances from his cast. But beyond that, it's so ambiguous that it's not tight enough. It's going all over the place. It goes for 2 hours and 20 minutes. There was no need for it to go this long. And then the ending, you're just sitting there and going, huh? Now, look, yeah. I will say Julia Roberts, there's something about her. It doesn't matter who she plays. She can be goofy. She could be the most serious. Whatever role she inhibits, you believe her character. She's probably the best thing about this film. I'm just really upset. This could have been such a brilliant film and it's not.
Okay, let's take a clip from this. This is Julia Roberts as Alma and Ayo Edebiri as her former protege, Maggie, and they confront each other with some hard truths.
I don't feel comfortable having this conversation with you anymore.
Not everything is supposed to make you comfortable, Maggie. Not everything is supposed to be a lukewarm bath for you to sink into until you fall asleep and drown.
And there are no rewards in death for suffering as much as possible in life.
You've constructed a life that hides your accidental privilege, neediness, desperate desire to impress. At least I have the self-respect to be obvious about what it is that I want. But you, it's all lies.
There's us having a whole conversation about that as we did. We have to move on to the next film. Yeah. Stars, Serena?
I'm giving this 2.5 as well.
Okay, Donald.
I'll give it 2. I had to wait in the pouring torrential rain to get into this at the Venice Film Festival. And then I got in there, I was very, very angry as the steam rose from my soaked garments. 2 stars, and that's generous.
Okay, that's ruined that for you. Next up, the documentary, Gerry Adams, A Ballymurphy Man. It features the former Sinn Féin leader in his own words. We're going to start by hearing from the man himself at the beginning of the film.
I hark back, and I hope it isn't a sort of a rosy view of it, to the early days in Ballymurphy. When I was in my late teens and we were trying to organise, we were banned, there were very few Republicans. And then within 10 months, it changed. And for me, one of the best periods of my activism was in that 69-70, when the entire community of the greater Ballymurphy area rose up and defeated the British Army. With stones and bottles and bin lids, and they were so well organized. There were youth committees, there were women's committees, a resistance council, and worked out things and managed their own affairs to the best of their ability. And politics is not worth anything unless it empowers people.
Okay, Donald, from the opening shots there of Gerry Adams on the beach playing with his dogs, it's clear where the sympathies lie in this film. Who's the director, Tricia Ziff?
I'm just an experienced director that I think she's worked with him before. But I think that you have to be honest about this, and you know that it is what it is, and what it is a documentary made with the cooperation of Gerry Adams. And as a result, it's going to be a sympathetic work. I mean, this film is not going to exist if you're putting him in a context where he's being constantly challenged on various things that he says down through the years. And I think, you know, you can object to that. You can feel, okay, that this is maybe kind of leaning a bit towards a celebration of Adams. But to my mind, I think it remains an extremely important document that I think is very useful in how it charts the history of those enormously difficult decades from his beginnings explained there in Ballymurphy to the peace process. And it's useful because, well, it's useful because simply of the what he saw and where he was and the information that he has to relate. But it's also useful because he is an extremely effective storyteller who has got, has always had, like, you know, a very kind of robust sense of humor. At some point he discusses, you know, the various attempts to do away with him and says that he was blessed with very bad assassins. And I have to say that though certainly I carry certain reservations through it, I did find it an extraordinarily compelling bit of storytelling that was full of insights. I mean, there's no way around this. The guy certainly has insights about the various things that he's passed through. I mean, his lines on the IRA are, you know, I think what we'd expect. I mean, that towards the end, he says, I have never disassociated myself from the IRA and I never will. You could say that's a little bit ambiguous, but nonetheless, they do address that issue towards the close.
Serena, the film's almost 2 hours long. Mm-hmm. Gerry Adams is the only talking head in that time. There are no other talking heads as part of this documentary. Can he sustain that?
Yeah, he can. I was shocked. I was shocked that I was gripped for the full 2 hours. My criticism of it only being Gerry Adams, which means that you only see one side of the story, is also my strength of it only being Gerry Adams, because you are getting pieces. But Donald's right. He's not being challenged, right? So you're getting Gerry's side of this. But as a result, you are getting stuff that you probably wouldn't have gotten from him had it been a contentious sort of documentary. I think this is really important because there's a lot of people like me who think we know what happened during the Troubles, but we actually don't. And I think everyone should actually watch this. And I was left, I couldn't believe how moved I was. I was crying by the end of it, Rick. It was a very powerful documentary.
Donald, the word activism is used early and often in this. It's doing an awful lot of heavy lifting, isn't it?
It is, particularly in the 1970s, that he talks about being imprisoned and talks about returning to activism afterwards. I mean, what can we say? I mean, like, we have a fairly sure notion. Well, we don't have a fairly sure notion. We have ideas of what went on that period. And I don't think that we can honestly expect the film to be any more explicit than that, given the position that he is in. But yes, it is true that the word activism appears throughout, and that could mean almost anything. And in this case, it does mean almost anything.
Stars from you?
I'll give it 4. It's a very compelling piece of work. I mean, as I say, people will have their reservations about it, but I think it's a very compelling piece of work. And Pritchard Zwyff is an experienced filmmaker, worked in Derry for a good while, really knows how to put a film together. Seamus de Garvey does cinematography, which is very impressive throughout. I think even if you approach this with some reservations, do approach it.
And thoughts and stars for you, Serena?
I'm with Donald on this. I like what he said there. Please do approach it, and I give it 4 as well.
Okay. Next, Roof Man. It is a stranger than fiction true story crime caper in which Channing Tatum plays the lead of a lovable rogue, let me get that right, and Kirsten Dunst is the local Christian that he befriends. Serena, who is Jeffrey Manchester, otherwise known as Roof Man?
He is an interesting man, and I have to start off by saying this is my pick of the week. Do you remember hearing about the Toys R Us man, the man who ended up sleeping in Toys R Us for 6 months?
Not even slightly, nothing.
I remember hearing it at the time, and so basically he is ex-military who came back to his family life, and he couldn't survive. So he turned, even though he's exhibiting criminal behaviour and doing criminal acts, you still can't help but feel for this man and want things to turn out for him. He turned to a life of crime because he wanted to give his life, his family, a better life. So what he did was he was trying to do crimes that didn't really impact people. So he was robbing from McDonald's. What he'd do is he became known as the Roof Man because he'd literally go the night before, he'd cut out a hole in the roof, he'd lower himself into McDonald's, and the next day when the employees would turn up, he'd rob the McDonald's. But he tried to do it as calmly and as nicely as possible. Like, there's this one scene where he goes, get your coats. And this one employee keeps going, I don't have a coat, I don't have a coat. And he stupidly gives the employee his own coat. So this person can actually be warm. But it's more than that. It's a story about love and not just romance. It's a man who just wants to connect with people and find love.
Donald, in the second part of this, he then goes from prison to hiding in a Toys R Us for months. How does that work?
It's fascinating. Yeah, you're talking there about if you remembered it. I mean, I had this sensation that I had a vague idea what the film was about before I went in, and I saw it and thought, I did that. The words Toys R Us, a man hiding in it, brought back this vague memories of a story which I hadn't really absorbed fully, but had some notion of the headlines. So, yeah, he gets into Toys R Us. He basically forms a little kind of alcove in a corner of the main shopping area, basically, which is walled off from there, gets in the sleeping bag, beds down there, gets himself a light. He gets money by robbing and selling video games from the store, but still, as the film tells it, he lives off the sweets. So it seems you're getting enough money to get from flogging video games, you at least buy yourself a decent meal. Along the way, he makes friends with Kirsten Dunst, a local Christian, and ultimately begins a romance with her. It says something about the USA, I think, that it seems plausible that he could claim to be a CIA spook. This is an unglamorous and interesting part of the country. I think it's in Northern Carolina, Southern Carolina, somewhere like that. Look, I like this film. What struck me was interesting. I made a comment on this on the way out to one of the people I was talking to, and I saw about two or three other critics all said the same thing. Here's a kind of perfectly decent mid-budget film, very entertaining, good actors, well-made, that would once have turned up weekly at cinemas. You'd pay your money and say, what's that? Let's go and see that, and have a perfectly good time. Nobody would confuse it with a masterpiece, but we then recognised it was a place for these things. You just don't get them anymore. If they end up anywhere, they probably end up streaming, but they don't even end up there that much. And I was very grateful to have it. I don't think it's any kind of masterpiece, but I do think it's a very enjoyable film, very well acted, with likeable actors. And I was interested to see that Derek Cianfrass, the director, is back. It feels like him trying to find a way back into mainstream filmmaking. He was best known for Blue Valentine, for The Place Behind the Pines, you know, over a decade ago, and then kind of went a little bit AWOL. So I think this demonstrates that he has got a very sure touch for this kind of storytelling, and I had a very good time.
Serena, how much of this is down to Channing Tatum being a charming presence on screen?
Do you know what? It's down to Channing and Kirsten Dunst. Yeah. They are both fabulous in this. And look, they may not get nominated for Oscars, but I think come award season time, they will be nominated at like maybe the Golden Globes, the Screen Actors Guild awards. Yeah. I think the performances they give, and it's not just, you know, the usual, oh, they're little charmers. No, they're giving great performances. And I do have to give a shout out to two actors who, if you see them in any movie, doesn't matter whether it's a good or a bad movie, you know they're going to elevate the film. That's Peter Dinklage, who plays this really grumpy store manager, and Australian Ben Mendelsohn. He
and I want more. There's also a good supporting turn from Lakeith Stanfield as his buddy. So, yeah, I agree. It's cast right down the sheet that sense that it's there for like a few minutes.
And you've got
Kirsten Dunst's pals.
Yeah, and you've got, her name escapes me at the moment. She's Juno Temple, who most people will know from Ted Lasso.
Yeah, yeah.
She's in this as well. So look, I as I said, this is my pick of the week.
Okay, stars from you?
I'm giving this 4 out of 5.
Okay, Donald?
I give it 4 as well, yeah. I liked it, a very good time.
Okay, our final film this week is Good Fortune. It's a comeback after cancellation of a sorts for the writer and comedian Aziz Ansari. What's he trying to do here, Donald? What's the film about?
It's an odd film. It's trying to be too many other odd films at the same time. One thing it's quite good at, actually, to be fair, is a look at the LA gig economy. As Ansari plays an Indian immigrant to Los Angeles who's lied to his parents about having a big job, but actually living in his car and working for an app that indirectly makes him a lackey of the well-off. One of those jobs is waiting for cupcakes at a newly fashionable outlet. That all feels depressingly convincing in Southern California. Anyway, he meets a VC millionaire played by Seth Rogen, does it well for a while with him, ends up getting sacked. Around about this time, Keanu Reeves turns up as the angel. I mean, I don't know if it's actually Gabriel or just an angel called Gabriel, if you know what I mean. Anyway, he is an angel called Gabriel. It's a funny one. He's kind of morose initially in a way that suggests that we're going for Wim Wenders' Wings of Desire or, Shudder, the awful and awfully titled LA remake City of Angels. Like Bruno Ganz in the German film, he gets a sample, simple, sensual pleasures when on earth, and you've got a touch there of what it is to be human. But it's also It's a Wonderful Life. There's quite a good joke in this bit. Keanu arranges for, after Aziz gets sacked, arranges for Seth Rogen and Aziz to swap bodies. So Aziz is now back, is now the rich guy living the rich guy's life. And the idea is, the angel says, he will see this life as empty and meaningless. At the end of the week, of course, he says, like, what are you talking about? This is great. I've got all this money and all this stuff. I'm not going back to my old life. So that's quite a good gag. The rest of the film is kind of a desperate effort to restore our thematic order and get us back to movie goodness. And there's too many implausible machinations. There's too much narrative panic. And ultimately, the sentimental ending seems to be dropped out of a clear blue sky into a much kinder America that in the film's own evidence doesn't actually exist. And I'll say one more thing before I go, and I really regret having to say this. I think Keanu Reeves is not good in this film. We spent 40 years and explain that, you know, he is not a bad actor. He's a good actor, like John Wayne. He's brilliant in the right part, but he really seems to be struggling here. There's kind of a laid-back anger, but he doesn't seem to believe a word of what he's required to speak.
Okay, whoa, there now, Pilgrim. Let's take a moment, first of all. Let's all take a beat. I'm going to take a clip from this, and I think it does come from earlier on in the film as well. It's Seth Rogen as Jeff, horrified by the lifestyle deficits of Aziz Ansari's Arj, whose life has been swapped with by the angel Gabriel, played, of course, by Keanu Reeves.
But you got to switch back, man. Give me my life back.
So what? I just go back to living in my car?
You lived in your car?
Yes, Jeff, I did. Why do you think an angel got involved? Because I had too many roommates?
Okay, that's bad. And I acknowledge that. So here's what I'm going to do. If you switch back right now, I'm going to give you $200,000.
You spent more than that on one of your watches.
Switch back, or you are evil, and this angel man will send you to hell forever. Smite him!
I can't send someone to hell. That's actually not my department.
Good God, man, you were very unhelpful.
You fired me because I put like $300 on your credit card. Why don't you tough it out for a few days?
I see what's happening here. Eat the rich, am I right? You think because I'm a tech bro, I can't live your life for a little while? I can live your life in my sleep. I came from nothing. I'm self-made.
You came from nothing.
Oh, I came from very, very humble beginnings.
What'd your parents do?
My father was an orthopedic surgeon, and my mother practiced law.
That's enough to make me go and see the film. So Keanu's just not up to scratch here as far as you're concerned.
I don't think so. No, I mean, I regret saying it because, I mean, I like everybody else in the world, I love Keanu Reeves, and I thought for the last sort of 20 or 30 years, he's found a niche for himself. He does brilliantly. But I just get this real sense he's not convinced by it. And these various different kind of films don't quite click together. I mean, there's a sense of kind of restless mind work here that we're going to try this, now we're going to try that. And none of the films get a chance to fully develop. So you don't really get the Frank Capra thing. That doesn't really work out. And when it is sort of clicking along, you get the Wings of Desire thing, and that feels like a whole different territory. So I don't think it holds together, no.
And stars from you?
Two, I'm afraid.
Two. Serena Bellissimo and Donald Clark, thank you very much for being with us this week. After The Hunt and Roofman go on general release in cinemas this weekend, Gerry Adams, A Bally Murphy Man and Ballad of a Small Player are both in selected cinemas from tomorrow, and the latter will be on Netflix from October 29th. Leonard and Hungry Paul is a new British-Irish drama on BBC, adapted from the best-selling novel by Irish author Ronan Heshin and narrated by Oscar-winning actor Julia Roberts. It's the story of two quiet, unassuming friends in their 30s, Leonard, played by Alex Lowther, an encyclopedia writer, and Hungry Paul, Laurie Kinniston, a part-time postal worker. Both of them meander through life in the gentle suburbs, taking comfort in their routines, in board games, and an aversion to small talk. I'm delighted to be joined now by Alex Lowther. Alex, welcome to Arena.
Thank you for having me.
For people who haven't yet read Ronan Heshin's book, and I highly recommend that they do, how would you describe the story of Leonard and Hungry Paul?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's a really gentle story between two best friends who lead, I suppose, relatively unextraordinary lives, and they do their best to be kind. And it follows a short period in their lives when Leonard has recently been bereaved of his mother, and he also meets Shelley, who's working with him in his office, and a burgeoning love story begins, which for Leonard is a huge next chapter.
What was your reaction to the story when you read the script first? Because in terms of a TV drama, it's not really dramatic at all, is it?
Yeah. And it sort of relishes that. It relishes not chasing after conflict, but allowing things to sort of unravel at its own quite gentle pace. I think I read the first couple of episodes, and then, as is the case often with telly, the scripts weren't finished. So I read the novel, went back to the novel, and I was just really just deeply charmed by it, which is, I think, has been a lot of the reaction of a lot of other people I've spoken to have come across the book, is that it sort of has its own kind of quiet confidence, and it's sort of celebration of people that that are, you know, busy living their own quiet lives, and I think that's something kind of rare in these days and times.
As I understand it, you met Ronan Eshin. Was that useful in terms of getting just to kind of understand Leonard a little bit better?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's always great for actors if you can meet the writer or the person who made the source material, because there's something of them, I find, in the characters that they've written, whether they're very far from them or very close. And I suppose there's something about Ronan's gentleness, and there's something quite wise about him, which I think bleeds into Leonard in some ways. Although Leonard's quite incapable in many others, there is a sort of sensitivity to the sort of smaller vibrations in life. I think, I don't want to speak for Ronan, but I think the two of them might share.
I think they do. And I think the interesting thing is, as somebody who's met Ronan on many occasions, there are little bits of him in your performance.
Oh, that's so nice. In what way? I'm not conscious of that.
Just in terms of the inflections of voice, or sometimes just in terms of looks, there are tiny, tiny moments of it, and it's quite lovely to see.
Oh, he's quite special, and he's, you know, he's a full-time civil servant, as well as a book writer and a musician in his own right. So he's a man, yeah, that I admire, because he wears many hats.
Talk to me about working with Laurie Kinnaston, who plays Hungry Paul. What was that like in terms of, obviously, if you don't manage to get that relationship right, that's the centre of the story, really.
Yeah, well, it was a really fortuitous thing in that Laurie and I have known each other for a good decade. I first met Laurie as a very young actor in my late teens, early 20s, both living in London, and it's our first time getting the chance to work with one another. So I suppose the material of a long-term friendship for us was already there, which is a delight, because it means a good chunk of the work is done before you've already arrived on set. And we kind of speak the same language, I suppose, and I think our way of working is quite similar. So it was a pleasure. I mean, it's rare you get to work with a close friend. So, I can only say that we had a good time.
Yeah, I want to play a little something from the series. Jamie Lee O'Donnell plays Shelley, the office fire warden, with whom Leonard strikes up this unlikely relationship. And here's a clip from the very first time they meet during a fire drill. Nice.
Me again. So, Mark Baxter, you actually wrote The Facts at My Fingertips. Great books, great books.
Thanks.
Yeah.
I'm not Mark Baxter.
I've seen you working on them.
Mark's the author. I'm the content supervisor. He decides what goes in the books I write stuff.
Really? That's a job?
I hope so.
Sorry, I didn't mean for it to come out like that, but that sounds a bit shite. So you do all the work, and then Mark Baxter gets his name on the book. Could you not get like a co-credit or something?
It doesn't really work that way. I'm more of a ghostwriter.
Ooh. Ooh. Are you being a ghost?
Yeah.
That's a great moment. Jamie Lee O'Donnell she's well known to Irish audiences, Michelle from Derry Girls, amongst other things. Had you worked with her before?
No, I think Laurie and Jamie Lee had, well, obviously Jamie Lee, so excellent in Derry Girls, and Laurie had a part in that. So they knew each other, but no, I don't think we'd ever crossed paths. And We're really lucky for many reasons to have Jamie Lee in our gang, not least because of the energy and the sort of verve that she brings to her own life, but also to her work, because of there being something quite bumbling and slow-natured about Leonard and Hungry Paul. I think it's really excellent that we have someone that has the energy that Jamie Lee does to sort of keep us from meandering too far. There's a sort of brightness that keeps the show really buoyant.
As viewers of TV shows, we can be quite cautious about accents in TV series like this. I think you've nailed the accent, but I mean, you have Irish family on both sides anyway, don't you?
Oh, that is such a relief to hear. Yeah, and quite rightly, because there's a long line of British actors doing bad Irish accents. But mum and dad, my dad's from the north and my mum's from, her family's from Mayo. So I guess hopefully some of that bleeds into where my voice sits. But we also worked, both Laurie and I, with a great dialect coach called Paul, who also worked with the British actors on The Wonderful Normal People. So hats off to him, really.
You became a regular at Grogan's during filming, as I understand it, and you developed a love for the cheese toasties in Grogan's. Is that true?
Yeah. It makes me sound like such a tourist, which I guess I was. But Laurie and I were put up in the middle of Dublin, which was just glorious. And it was that time. I don't know if you're in Dublin in April or May, but it just seemed to be sunny all the time. The weather was like just strangely beautiful. So we had a good time on our evenings off. I wish I could film everything in Dublin.
Leonard and Hungry Paul, it celebrates the unsung lives of very quiet individuals, and it casts a spotlight on maybe people who normally would shy away from the attention. I mean, that's quite unusual in a TV show and in an acting role, isn't it?
It is, and it slightly makes for a hard conversation, right? It's hard to really explain where to start with this show. But I think that's something rare, I think, and something that I find, at least as a reader when I first came across Ronan's book, really satisfying, that it was people without great ambition but who take a lot of care of each other and really interested in spending time with their family and in conversation. There feels like something sort of impossible, that impossibly rare about such a quiet story, which I'm really glad that it's got made.
I want to take maybe just one more moment from the series. This is where Leonard gets a visit from his boss, Mark Baxter, played by the actor Paul Reed.
Lenny, how was the weekend?
Not great, really.
Actually,
my mother, sadly.
Hi. She new? I think she's new. Anyway, yes, I just stopped by to see how our book is coming along. Yeah,
actually, great. I think it's going really well.
Excellent. That's what I like to hear.
If you like,
is definitely new.
Yeah, I think they moved some people down on the third floor.
She's new to me. Anyway, yes, I was hoping we could deliver by Friday.
That won't be easy. I thought we had to end the month.
We did, only I need to get this out of the way before the team building weekend.
I don't know. It's not a great time for me.
You? No, it's not for you. It's only for the interns.
Didn't know we had interns.
Yeah, sure we do. Well, we have one, Libby.
So it's going to be just you and Libby on a team building weekend?
Yeah, I thought she could benefit from some one-on-one time. You see, the thing is,
she's new.
Bingo! Right, gotta go, Lenny. Listen, Lenny, you're the best. The best!
Julia Roberts is the narrator of the series, Alex. Is it unusual to hear her narrate your character's life as he goes along?
Yeah, I mean, the chances of getting an actor of the caliber of Julia Roberts to narrate such a quiet, unassuming show seem sort of impossibly unlikely. But there's something, I mean, both the sort of richness that Julia Roberts just brings in and of herself, but also just her warmth and her wryness. Like, if you were going to draw a list of dream narrators for the show, Julia's at the top of that. But I think the book, as I understand it, spoke to her, and she'd come across it years ago. And I think there's something special about that book. It has drawn sort of quite fervent admirers, and yeah, I mean, what a coup to have Roberts as the all-seeing eye in the show.
And congratulations as well on the other thing that people can see you in TV at the moment, in Disney's Alien Earth, the prequel to Alien. You're playing Joe Hermit in that. Are there rumours of a second series? Is there any confirmation that might happen?
I think we should know pretty soon, but nothing for sure either way. But yeah, it's funny, hey, like in terms of something plot-driven and action-obsessed, there's Alien Earth. So I think shows like London Hungry Pool are the perfect antidote to everything else.
It has been a joy talking to you, Alex Lawther. Thanks so much for joining us tonight on Arena.
Thank you so much.
The first two episodes of Leonard and Hungry Paul are on BBC One tomorrow night, and that starts at 9 p.m. and we'll be reviewing it on tomorrow night's Arena. And you're listening to Thursday night's Arena. On Monday night, we heard from Linda McCarthy and Kevin McDermott, who were among the writers whose stories have been shortlisted for this year's RTE Short Story Competition in honour of Francis McManus. Chosen from over 2,000 entries, the 10 stories that have made it onto the shortlist have also been published on the RTE Culture website. The judges this year are Jan Carson, Neil Hegarty and Tristan Rosenstock. And on Friday week, they'll be joining me for a special Arena live programme in the Pavilion Theatre in Dunlira, along with the 10 shortlisted writers, to discuss this year's stories, hear from them in live performance, and to announce the top prizes, including the first prize of €5,000. Here on Arena, we'll also have an opportunity to speak with some more of those writers, over the next week. One story is being broadcast every night on RTE Radio 1's Late Date. This evening, I'm joined by Sinead Troy, who's with me here in studio, and Peter McCauley, who's on the line from Derry. You're both very welcome. Sinead, I'm going to start with you. Tell me what your story is about.
Hi, Rick. Thank you. My story is about a TD. He's running for re-election, and a man from his past. He's confronted by a man from his past. And this confrontation is reverberations for his personal life and his political life as well.
Okay, let's have a listen to something from that story. This is from Feeding Time by Sinead Troy, and it's read by Andrew Bennett.
The first sight that will greet the swarm of weekend shoppers at the village centre will be your disproportionately looming head. Thanks to some digital resourcefulness, your weather-beaten visage is considerably smoother and less weather-beaten than in reality. The image eventually selected is one of you staring down the lens of the camera, wearing a congenial half-smile. No teeth. This is apparently perceived as being more trustworthy. You are wearing a tie, but not a jacket, meant to demonstrate a balance between approachability and a respect for formality, which, according to the party's witless PR consultant, is your specific brand. Supposedly, floating voters find formal dress distancing, and it was this alleged insight that informed the party's slogan for this election cycle: standing with you, working for you. Emphasis on the word for, which is italicised and underlined. Your face and the tagline that accompanies it are emblazoned across the roll-up banners placed on either side on the stand and on the stacks of leaflets which overwhelm your makeshift table. Posters are ubiquitous throughout the village, hovering over harried pedestrians.
What's the inspiration behind this, Sinead?
Well, at the time of writing it, I was reading a political memoir, which describes the canvassing process and the various absurdities of that. So I think that was really what sparked it. But at the same time, I was discussing this book with my boyfriend, and we were talking about how shame and doubt has cast such a shadow over so many people, particularly Irish people. But on the flip side of that, there's a certain personality type that seems kind of impervious to that. So I kind of wanted to explore what does shame and doubt feel like to somebody who isn't typically burdened with it.
Peter, welcome along to the programme. Tell me what your story is about.
Hi, Rick. How are you doing? My story is about two brothers. It's set in my home city of Derry. It's two brothers with very contrasting life experiences. One has been living away and working away in Manchester. The other has been sort of stuck at home. The brother who's been away comes back to Derry. A job has opened up and he's moved back. He sort of feels the city has called him back. And when he comes back, he's living with his mum and his brother for a while. And he discovers, to his kind of shock, that his brother has descended into a very strange form of madness, a kind of a mental neurosis. That's basically the premise of the story.
Okay, this is Wolves by Peter McCauley, and this is a section read by Paul Mallon.
John had been working in Manchester for 3 years when one morning he realised that life was short. A job had opened up back in Derry. He'd been missing the city, yearning for it on bad nights. "You can leave Derry, but it never leaves you," someone had said. They were right. "She'll be back Friday evening," he told his mother on the phone. "Oh, grand. You'll be staying with us then?" "Well, until I get sorted in my own place, maybe a couple of weeks," said John. "Your room's ready anyway. Never changed it much after you left, to be honest. It was always your room. I kind of knew you'd be back someday. Mothers know them kind of things." "Well, as I say, it'll just be for a few weeks," said John, "till I find my own place." "Aye, we come and go as you please. You're your own man now. It'll be good for Rory, though, to have you back." She left that last sentence hanging in the air.
Peter, I understand the inspiration for your story came from a revenge tragedy?
It did indeed, yes. A number of years ago, I was doing a degree through the Open University in English. And we, as part of the degree, we studied a play called The Duchess of Malfi by John Webster. Webster was a contemporary of Shakespeare, so this was a very dark Jacobean tragedy. And in the play, there's a character called Ferdinand, and Ferdinand is the twin brother of the Duchess. But through the course of the play, Ferdinand develops this very bizarre, dark, twisted mental neurosis. It actually has a name. It's called lycanthropy. And lycanthropy is the sort of morbid, obsessional fear that you're in the process of turning into a wolf. So that was basically, I sort of subconsciously must have lifted that idea, basic premise, and took it into contemporary Derry. And I just let these three characters, the mother and her two sons, just deal with it and see what came out of that, you know.
What's it like hearing it being read by Paul Mallon?
It's fantastic. It's lovely to hear a fellow Derryman reading it. And I think it's actually essential for the story because I sort of like to write in the Derry dialect and it makes it authentic, gives it a great sense of place to hear it voiced in the local dialect. Yeah, so it's great. It sounds, that snippet sounded really good, you know.
Sinead, yours went out on late date last night. What sort of feedback have you been getting since then?
Oh, well, everyone's been lovely and very supportive. And oh my God, you couldn't have picked a better reader than Andrew Bennett. He did just a fantastic job. Very strange experience. I listened to it by myself.
Just was that a deliberate process. Move?
Yes, it was. It was because... I had an experience before of listening to something that I wrote on the radio years ago. I was shortlisted for the PJ O'Connor with the radio awards, and I listened with my family, which was very embarrassing. I wanted to crawl out of my skin because there was sexual references and things that I'd forgotten that were included in the play. So I learnt my lesson. I said I'll listen to the next one completely by myself.
And this is far from your first time hearing your work on the radio, Peter, as well.
That's right, Rick. I had the very great privilege to be shortlisted in this very competition 2 years ago in 2023 with another story of mine, story set in Derry called On Craigavon Bridge. So, yeah, it was a great thrill hearing it read at that stage by an actor too. And it's incredible when you've worked at a story at your desk and then you actually hear it coming out of somebody else's mouth on national radio. It's a real thrill for a writer, you know.
It's been lovely to talk to both of you tonight, and I look forward to seeing you a week on Friday at the Pavilion Theatre. Sinead Troy and Peter McCauley, thanks for joining us on Arena this evening. You can hear one story from the RTE Short Story Competition shortlist every night for the next week on Late Date at 11:20 here on RTE Radio 1. You'll hear Peter McCauley's story Wolves tonight at 11:20. And as we said, Sinead Troy's story Feeding Time was broadcast last night. But fear not, you can listen back to it as a podcast. The stories can all be found on rte.ie/writing and rte.ie/culture leading up to the RTE Short Story Awards night, and that's live here on Arena, coming from the Pavilion Theatre in Dunlera in County Dublin on Friday the 24th of October. If you'd like to come along, there are tickets still available, and you'll find those at pavilionthatre.ie. And that's Thursday night's Arena. Reg Luby produced. Paula Shields was our researcher. Broadcast coordinator tonight was Ollie Hamilton, and sound supervision by Harry Bookless. I'll talk to you tomorrow night from 7. John Creedon is next.